Well, hello. I really have to say, I still need to get used to the scale of this event. Good to see that all of you are here. Thanks very much to the people who are organizing this for allowing me to speak here. I was here last year already, and it was kind of a disaster, to be very honest. I had my nice presentation and had everything written down, and I brought the whole thing with me. And then right before the event, I was sitting there with a lot of Republica veterans, and who were talking about how uncool it was to come here with a prepared presentation. It went okay last time, and I was very, very proud that for the first time in my life I even had a PowerPoint presentation with me that was supposed to masquerade the fact that I had this written out text with me. This year, this is different. In this year, now I know what is cool and what is not cool here. And that's why I brought another written out presentation with me. A thinking that is not worried about the direction in the first place, a way of thinking that looks for insights and would like to achieve something with language and through language. Let's call it reality. This is what Ingeborg Bachmann wrote in her Frankfurt lectures on poetry. I'm not entirely sure whether that's possible, but this is the plan that I have and the goal that I have with this talk, to think without being worried about the direction of the thinking. The idea, love out loud, we would like to look at that slowly, we would like to look at different aspects, but at different variations, and we would like to look at different variations and test them. This might be a bit unconventional, but to be very honest, I really don't know what is conventional at this conference at Republica. And these days, I often understand the Republica as an opportunity to try something, to test something that is maybe not completely perfected yet, maybe not a complete theory, but something that is just a sentence yet, something that is still a work in progress, and to see what happens if you take it seriously, because everything else would be strange. As if we had this motto, and if we didn't look at that motto, that would be strange as well. So what should and what could love out loud mean? Can I do that? Do I want it? Who would I be if I did it? Who would I be if I said it? Whom or what? Who or what would we be if we said it or if we implemented it? And who is we? And who are the others? Are they also us? Or are they others? Love out loud, I would like to try to look at it in four different variations. One. As an imperative. An imperative clause is a clause that that expresses a command or a plea to do something. The first thing that is interesting is the grammatical form of love out loud. It's an act of speech, an imperative that commands, that makes people, that invites people to do something. It doesn't say loving out loud. It doesn't say I want to love out loud or let's get loud. Is that possible? Is it possible to make someone or ask someone to love? Or is it possible to demand that someone loves loud?
To which imperatives can be formed? Leap, love, that sounds strange. Love, loud, and wild, that sounds like an accident. But there remains some paradox in there. The love, as faith, it has something that you cannot grasp. You cannot decide to love. no matter how much you want to, you can't decide to not love anymore, no matter how much you suffer because of love. Love, lust, is too fragile, too intimate. You cannot control it. She resides within you, but it doesn't belong to you. And maybe that's exactly the magic of love, that you cannot put it into a fixed place. Or differently, no command, no plea can bring us to find it, to love. So love and lust also cannot be restricted. No law, no government can forbid us from loving. So people don't understand that who want to
People who want to pathologize and who want to criminalize queer people and queer love don't understand that. They don't understand that love cannot be ended and it can't just go away. To love or not to love goes beyond every restriction, every force, being forced to do anything. In the first instance, there is some resistance to the form and the grammar of the sentence because it demands something that you cannot demand. Two, not out of shame, but not in order not to hurt anyone, I hurt my own suffering. And that's what we often do with the truth, said Richard Krenitzky in one of his poems. Now the meaning of this demand, of this request, shifts slightly when you focus on the out. So if you don't focus on the love, what is demanded of you is to articulate that love. So which love are you talking about? Is this the love to someone, to a way of being in the world, to an ideology, the love of an ideology, of a vision of a more open egalitarian society, love of some game, to a religion, to a for people like me, whose way of loving is often considered perverse, sick, demented, like less valuable, sinful, unnatural, or sometimes as godless. For us, there's a historical contingency. If we live in a state where our love and our lust are being criminalized, and for us it is a questionable coincidence whether we grow up in an area where we have to expect to be repressed by the state or non-state actors, where we need to expect officials or mobs of people who are just standing in the street come to attack us or even kill us. Even if the coincidence has made it so that we grow up in a society where there is state-organized violence, where state-organized violence against our love and lust does not exist anymore, then this practiced fear that we've practiced over hundreds of years of our love and the fear of what others think about what we are and the fear of what others think this knowledge of what we are allows them to do. This fear is still there. And this tying together this label of what people think we are and how this empowers others to make fun of us, to shame us, to humiliate us, to look down upon us, and this empowering for them to exclude us, this is something that is not individual, like that is not an individual thing. It doesn't only happen to the people who love outside the norm. It's also formed in stories told about us, in photos, in pictures that the news and the media use when they write write about same-sex civil partnerships or about Pride Parade in Berlin. You can see it in TV series and in movies where we only appear when people who are acting are actually non-heterosexual and when people don't even think that they would be capable of acting as a heterosexual person. And tying together the stigma and this microcosm of humiliation is also in the gaps, in the things that is not being said, and in all that we find ourselves in all the places where we do not appear. We are the people who are invisible. We are the people who are shameful with a shameful silence. And we are those who children should not know about, at least not too early. And we are those who may not be warned about anymore, but if someone knows about us, then it's still a burden. And that's still the better way that we can be. In other places, it's even worse. In other places, we become visible, but only as the demonic other, as those that are not natural, as the opposite of the natural, normal way of being a family. This mechanism doesn't only hit or affect those who love different from the norm, but also those who look differently, those who believe differently, or who have other bodies. It also affects those who are simply poor, who don't have work, who live in precarious circumstances, and who societal humiliation also affords some guilt for the situation they live in. There are some of the older generation who are still afraid of camps and of prisons and to feel it under their skin. They still talk about the subletter when they talk about the love of their life. Even today, the word that they could use to describe themselves, homosexual or gay or lesbian or queer, they still can't say those words. As if using that word, by using that word, the truth that they're already living actually came into the world, actually became real and irreversible. But even some of us in this later generation often or sometimes try in many contexts to pass as something different. We try to pass. We try to change ourselves. We masquerade. We deny what we are, and we try to fit in. That's not something, it's not a one-time event. That's not just a threshold that you cross once. Just like coming out and just like loving out loud. Neither is a singular act that you can just do once. It demands permanent decisions when to speak, when to remain silent, and when to resist things that are being said. This decision or these decisions to deny your selfhood or to articulate your love, and this does not demand the same of every single person, this decision. Someone who is white and Christian, someone who comes from the middle class or who has a secure income, someone who has social or economic privilege, someone like that knows that they are less vulnerable. This symbolic and institutional status is protection, and people who know that also know that they are less vulnerable to societal humiliation.
The intersectionality of personalities, when that is not considered, is an own way of marginalizing people. Of course, it's easier to make the own deviant desire known to the public if no other problems arise. Yet, maybe exactly because of that, it is necessary to be open, to not mask oneself, but to reveal the masks and to show ourselves as us, as people with desires, with love, and to do that without shame and without fear.
Ich vermute übrigens, trinken aus der Flasche gehört auch zu einem Faktor.
I think drinking straight from the bottle also adds something to your coolness around here. So, yeah.
Dieses sich zu zeigen,
this showing oneself
hat nicht nur in designierten Zonen statt.
Doesn't just happen in designated areas, in closed rooms, in private, as the new right demands of others, and just like the German New Right Party, AfD, also demands from oneself. Homosexuality is nothing that you can just turn off, nothing, no piece of clothing that you can just take off. But your love, your sexuality belong to you. They belong to me as a natural way of my being, just as my being right-handed. The topic desire is not always relevant. It's not even the most relevant aspect of my personality. Lately, homosexuality seems to be the most important thing to people with homophobia, just like Islam and other religions seem to be most important to people who object them. So, the natural way of talking about love, queer desires, and the political mechanisms of stigmatization here and elsewhere, and the wish to keep my freedom to think differently, to form different alliances locally and internationally, to emphasize that. I want to be aware of identity movements that try to form marginalized groups and within political movements. And I don't want to try to form authentic political cultures, and I want to question our own political rituals, whether they close us off and tie us down instead of opening us up and enabling us. I want to talk about symbolic capital, and this isn't I don't want to blame anyone, but these are questions I want to ask myself. I don't want to freeze in some form of political gesture. I don't want the term love out loud to sort of overpower smaller political gestures. And to quote Claude Lévi-Strauss, you can move within identities, but you cannot live within identities. And so maybe this is my biggest concern about love out loud. I didn't turn queer to again be restricted within other forms of speech. And I don't want to write sentences that in turn disregard other people's way of being and other vocabulary, other terms, other expressions, other alliances, other hopes should be made possible. I also write in order to talk about the pain of people being marginalized, people who experience violence. I want to write about things that some people want to be forgotten. I want to talk about violence, and I want to slowly but surely put these things back into a space where they can be visible.
And that is something that doesn't need to be loud, but it needs some careful writing that is searching for something, seeking something. But first and foremost, you need to listen attentively. We need to be careful that we don't unlearn that we don't, because we're being loud and because we're desperate and because we know that there is political necessity and because we have pain and there's necessary resistance against the violence, that out of those necessities we only use loud and simple political diction. It's important that we don't forget and that we don't lose the dynamic, the silent, and the hidden forms of love and of desire, desiring. I imagine that one of the reasons people cling to their hate so stubbornly is because they sense once hate is gone that they will be forced to deal with pain. James Baldwin in Notes of a Native Son.
Love out loud,
that could also mean resistance against hate, against the omnipresent racism, against the racism against people, against disregard of people, something that in recent years is not only happening in secret, but strangely proud, and it's being exhibited strangely proudly. This extremism that is not only a taboo, that has very much arrived in the middle of our society. This extremism has lost its shame. Hate is something that is being done sure of you, where people are sure of themselves, and it is loud. This invitation of hate to take it on is something that you need to decline. So first of all, yes, love out loud against this hatred. If you respond to hate with hate, then you've already been changed. This is a success that we shouldn't afford those fanatics about religion and pure ideology. This is a success that we should not grant them. Every way of being complicit with the apocalyptic scenario of a civil war, with this fantasy of completely getting rid of our civil society, of civil kinds of behavior, if you want an egalitarian and open democracy, if you want to protect the rule of law, then you cannot succumb to this maelstrom of violence and hate. For example, the freedom of religion for Muslims cannot be protected if you say that only atheism is acceptable. If we're serious about the freedom of religion, then we cannot say that every sign of religion, whether it's Christian or Muslim or Jewish, then we cannot describe it as undemocratic or somehow backwards. Representative democracy cannot be defended by changing the rules for the German parliament just so someone who you simply don't like cannot become president. If we want to be serious about parliamentary representation, once a party is considered as conforming to our basic law, then that party gets all the same rights and the same money as all the other parties. Then we need to rely on the means and the tools that the law and the basic law are giving us. Openly demonizing sex workers is equally unacceptable, just because you can use it to supposedly make fun of your political enemies and show them to be hypocrites. It may be superfluous to emphasize this, but also putting on fire cars and destroying offices is not something that is somehow politically acceptable, just because it goes against people whose political position is inhumane and denies other people's human dignity. Criticizing the essentialism of neo-Nazi right-wing ideology
this criticism is not enough. A criticism of how right-wing radical programs deny people's human dignity, if that criticism only uses its own denial of human dignity, this is a criticism that contradicts itself. If you want to go beyond those mechanisms of hate, needs to analyze the structures of hate and not attack the people who are part of those. In that sense, yes, I agree, we need something else against the hate. So we need to use something that is not hate. We cannot simply oppose populism with intellectual simplicism. We can only respond to this ideology of purity with a rhetoric of impurity. There's no reason to be defensive in that. There's no reason to be shy, because this vision of an inclusive open society is not just more beautiful and more egalitarian, it's also much more pragmatic, because within this society more people can find themselves, because it also contains different ideas of the good life, and it can contain different ideas of the good life. For this purpose, we don't need love to another or for one another. A pluralistic, heterogeneous society only works when there is not too much of a demand of love, when you don't demand too much love of others. We don't need to be loved, we just want the same rights. We don't need love, just respect would be enough. And for me, to be very honest, some polite just indifference would also be very much sufficient. We don't need to be loved. And I personally am incapable of loving everyone and all ideas in the same way. Of course, some ideas and some habits and some rituals are more close to me. Others seem absurd to me. Others are sad. Others a bit, well, strange. Others I don't understand. Others I find funny. Others I am surprised about. And I often am not only astonished about the lives of strangers, but also lives of friends in my own life. A pluralistic society, if you really want this society, also means to tolerate and to respect these differences. Everything else would simply be collective narcissism. Respect, recognition, equal rights, those are necessary just as much as criticism and resistance to the mechanisms of hate. And not least, we need solidarity and support for those who are being excluded because they're marked as others. What this means, and what this can mean in terms of implementation, how you can implement this? Well, if someone is being hurt and humiliated and denied their rights, then these people shouldn't need to defend themselves. Someone who's being humiliated, someone who's being hurt, someone who's being attacked doesn't have to defend themselves, shouldn't have to defend themselves. There should be others who stand there and to defend the dignity of every single other person. There need to be others who resist. There need to be others who are not affected, but who feel like they're affected and who feel like they are being attacked as well. Those who help and who contribute need to ask for equality for those who don't have it. Those who do not believe need to defend the rooms for those who believe, and the other way around. A society where everyone only wants to save themselves is not a society. That's a neoliberal spectacle, nothing else. Instead, we need a discourse that is based on recognition and that can think recognition and solidarity together, where social questions are not being used to oppose political questions, and where the rights of workers and the rights of others who are marginalized because they're queer or because they're black or female, where there's no hierarchy between these different rights, as if there was some priority, as if some questions of suffering and pain were questions of luxury, where others are important.
Ein falscher Gegensatz.
That's wrong. That is a false dichotomy. Nobody who is poor perceives that first and foremost as an economic deprivation. This poverty also goes along with political invisibility. Someone who is poor isn't simply marginalized in an economic way. This poverty is also a taboo, it's being stigmatized. And in a society where we barely talk about social class anymore, the burden and the shame of social need is on these people and is on themselves. Just like the social question is a political one, something that is closely tied to recognition, the political disregard for queer or black people is something that has economic consequences.
Equal rights, Black Lives Matter, the queer movement or other movements, they're not just about cultural or political disregard or language games in an empty room. It's about social thinking. It's about the fear of going into the streets or to school. It's about defenselessness of your own body, of your own language. It's about jobs. It's about housing, which are not as readily available to the people whose names or bodies are being neglected. Political and social questions belong together, and we will not be dictated something else. When we talk about respect or solidarity, we all always have to think of both of them. Social respect, human dignity, social respect and political participation go together as an indivisible part of human dignity. It belongs to the mechanism of
domination.
That the that seeing that experiencing pain.
As is part of the mechanism of domination to ban understanding the suffering that this domination produces.
Often the people who want to dominate.
In most cases, the people who want to be engaged in activism and who want to help are those who are already involved. But then under those questions of what can we do and what should we do, there's something else. There's something about why are others so loud or they are so loud, we can't reach anyone anyway. Depending on the context, there's often some mentioning of how your own limited how limited your own perspective is, something that we call a filter bubble recently. The longer I listen to this, the more I am touched. And after a while, I also started to understand or to hear this feeling of powerlessness. It's also a way of disempowering yourself if you constantly ask yourself what your own activism can actually achieve. It's a bitter form of self-disenfranchisement to disregard and to devalue your own positions because you're telling yourself that they're not the position of others or the position of the majority. Majorities and hegemonic positions are something that you can work for and that you can achieve, not by simply looking at the others and perceiving them as stronger than they actually are, but by networking and by connecting with one another and by using the other utopias and testing your own utopias and ideas and visions and potentially improve them, and by developing utopias and visions of how we want to live together. It's not something that's going to be fast. It's going to take some time. It takes energy. It might demand self-criticism, it might demand to redo and rework your own ideas and visions, but that's what political action is. Once you put an idea of economic efficiency and a metric of economic efficiency to value or devalue political activism, once you start doing that, any political engagement, any political activism, any analytical thinking, any democratic way of forming opinions, of making decisions, is being devalued, because then everything takes too long or it doesn't show results quickly enough. This logic of shopping is something that you cannot apply to social and political discourse or to the development of political ideas. You need patience, and you also need generosity. You need to be willing to take go the extra mile. You need to be willing and to be courageous enough to speak in a quiet manner, and you need to be accepting, and you need to be generous to excuse other people's mistakes, rather than this constant hermeneutics of mistrusting others. And there needs to be some way of a more gentle way of being together. In an interview, Toni Morrison recently talked about her father. I said, he worked as a welder. One day he told me he had found the perfect way of welding, and he had welded the perfect line. And because it was so perfect, he had put his initials next to it. I said, "Well, Daddy, nobody's going to see that." And he answered, "Well, but I know that they're there." Maybe that's what I want, and maybe that is what these reflections on this motto end with. This idea of us simply welding and us working on welding this perfect line, and that we should be proud that if we manage this line once, that then this knowledge of having done that is something that carries us, even if it's not an instant gratification or if it doesn't provide any instant gratification, and that we then continue to work on the next line that needs to be welded. So within this is what political action consists of. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. If this is how it goes, then next year I'll try without a PowerPoint presentation. I think we have some time. Yeah, we would have time maybe if you want, potentially for questions or comments, and then we're going to make some space for the next event.